Hello there, everybody. It's me, Gary Kidney, the co-host of You've Got to Be Kidding Me on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
And I am Liam Jones, my full name, and I am also a part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network as a co-host for You've Got to Be Kidding Me.
We are a TNA history podcast that covers TNA 1 month at a time. We cover all the drama, all the matches, all the Vince Russo nonsense you could ever want in your life.
Have you heard of TNA? I bet you have, but would it be funnier if two people made jokes over it the whole time? Probably.
So if that sounds like fun to you, check it out on this very Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network, and Liam will do bits and whatnot.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hey, kids, do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling, too. This is Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins with a regular Chris Novembrino.
Yeah, that's, you're getting travel edition Jeffrey Hawkins, people. But I, yes, the anchor of this show, the Lou Gehrig, or the Cal Ripken, either way, baseball metaphors, I'm here as per usual, diligent. Jeff, traveling. Where are you this week, Jeffrey?
I am in Snobsdale, Arizona.
Snobsdale, my old stamping grounds, as yeah, it were.
So I apologize for any difference in audio, but I had forgotten my power cord to my computer, even though I brought my setup with me, and I'm just like, it's going to be that kind of day. So I have plugged in the mic to the parents' computer. It appears to be working. Chris has had 5 bowel movements in the last day. It's
That was more of a Friday thing. But point is, people, I'm feeling great. Let me tell you, Fiverr is fantastic, and I'm glad that we got that. I was saying that Jeff and I need to start talking about some real stuff off air, and I just think it's fantastic that we took that, brought it to the table to all of you people. If you aren't getting, hold on, Jeffrey. People, if you aren't getting enough fiber in your diet, I want you to take the Novi Challenge this January. Let's do it. 2 salads a week, people. 2 salads a week. Transform your life. Transform your life. 2 salads a week. Come on, Novi Challenge.
Chicken salad, taco salad, Jello salad. Those don't
gotta make those sure don't you got, you know, like real lettuce in there. Don't do that iceberg. You know, you need roughage. We're looking for some romaine, people.
The old Chinese proverb said, may you live in interesting times. And boy, do we. Chris, according to a story in the Wall Street Journal, Vince McMahon is looking to get back in power in WWE. It's also become a major subject among WWE talent and employees. The story noted on noted that a lawyer for former 80s referee Rita Chatterton had sent a demand for $11.75 million to McMahon's attorney, Jerry McDivitt, stemming from her claim of a raping incident in the back of McMahon's limo. The Wall Street Journal was given a copy of this letter, and also were told of another one that happened at a massage parlor. But, according to this story, Vince McMahon believes that he could have outlasted this and it would have blown over. And he does have voting control of the shares. So what odds do you give that Vince McMahon could find his way back running the show again at age 77?
I think he was never going to let this go. I think at the time we said that this was a forced resignation, not a retirement of choice. And Vince McMahon doesn't like losing. So I think it's entirely possible that he is still, to some degree, influencing the company. It seems to me like, honestly, the sweet spot for Vince McMahon would be to orbit as the majority shareholder, still have some of your key people in the company. Like, it's not lost to me that Kevin Dunn, of all people, still has a job. You still have some of your key people in the company. The show still kind of looks like the way you want it to look. So it's not going through a massive transformation. You still get to say you're involved in the company, but you hide from public facing. Now, the problem is that for Vince McMahon, he could never accept that as a sweet spot. And I think all we need to do is look back to the extremely awkward final 6 weeks of Vince McMahon's tenure in the company, where he needed the crowd to do a thank you, Vince. He needed John Cena to come out there and give approbation to Vince. He had Titus O'Neil come out and basically serve as a mouthpiece when he became the goodwill ambassador, because the world needs more goodwill. And then he needed us to recognize him as he introduced the all-important 1037th edition of SmackDown. Or was it 1158? I forget, whatever it was. It doesn't really matter, right? It was an arbitrary number, people. And I think all of this belies the mentality of Vince McMahon, a guy who just can't let it go. And I think that that's just really, really consistent with this guy's entire biography. He's always been combative. I actually watched, before this news broke, I just, you know, was cleaning the house earlier this week, and I had a pretty good, up until the end, two-hour retrospective on Vince McMahon's career. And throughout this, all of the video clips, at points where he doesn't need to be combative, he is combative with people. At points where, like, he could just shut up, he still needs to fight. Because Vince McMahon, above all else, always needs to win. And right now, Vince feels like he's losing. And that's never going to sit well. Not ever.
Speaking of Vince McMahon, I think you probably may have been watching The Nine Lives of Vince McMahon on Vice, which premiered on Tuesday night. Less than 100,000 viewers. I watched it. If you know Vince, it's nothing you don't already know, and there weren't a lot of people talking, because it seemed to be it was only Vince Russo, our friend Brandon Thurston, Brian Alvarez, and Dave Meltzer, and a couple others. But a large number of people turned it down, including Chris Jericho, Jim Cornette, Eric Bischoff, Brian Danielson, CM Punk, Mick Foley, Jim Ross, Jerry Briscoe, Jerry Jarrett, and Ted Mann of the Wall Street Journal. So Vince is coming into power, and nobody wants to talk about Vince either.
I'll shout out what I was watching. It was it's called The Most Important Man in Wrestling History by WrestlePod. Pretty good right up until the end. There's a kind of nuclear bad take specifically about the allegations, which he did make it some time ago, but even with the knowledge he had then, I thought it was a bad take, and it's aged really poorly. But in terms of the actual background of Vince McMahon, I gotta have an analysis of who the dude is. I think you look at his bio, you can kind of anticipate what he wants to do here. I this, as crazy as this sounds, and clearly this is not my opinion, I think in Vince's mind, you know, what he did isn't really that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, given what we know, of course it is. Like everything from just quietly taking the money out of the company's coffers to the actual nature of the allegations, all of the stuff is a big deal. But I think in Vince's mind, you know, you're bigger than that. And I think beyond all of that, maybe this is the biggest problem with his morality, right? That if you win, you're moral. That's a good way to describe it for him,
definitely.
Yeah, the ultimate morality for him is being a winner, and so if he wins, in a way, it absolves all of his sins.
Winner gets to write all the rules, pretty much. Yeah.
And the history too, right? Yeah, which has been a lived experience for him, right? He won the WCW war, and so when you win, you get to write the history. You get to tell everyone what really happened. And I think that that's like really poisoned this dude's brain.
Quick look.
Uh-oh, it looks like we lost Jeff here for just a second, so I'm going to vamp for all of you people as we try to get Jeffrey back into the mix.
Am I back?
Jeff is back.
Okay, there we go. Mandy Rose, NXT Women's Champion, fired on December 7th after abruptly dropping the title the night before to Roxanne Perez on NXT Deadline. According to those close to the situation, Matt Bloom informed Shawn Michaels about content on Rose's Fantime subscription service that got more racy of late. While not confirmed, there are those who believe Rose was making more money posting photos and making custom videos for subscribers that contain nudity. While WWE in the past has marketed women and was responsible for many posing nude in Playboy, that was a different era. And what they found out about crossed what they considered the allowable line, given they had promised television partners and sponsors a family-friendly product. Mandy Rose was live streaming and getting tipped at one point, according to someone viewing the video. Said if she wasn't tipped $400, she would end the stream. In another, she told her streamer to message her about what they want her to do in custom videos. There were also multiple nude shots of her and her fiancé, former WWE wrestler Sabu Piscitelli, a.k.a. Tino Sabatelli, in sexual positions. When Michaels found out earlier in the week about the new content, the NXT television show was rewritten and Rose was ordered to drop the title to Perez. She was fired the next morning. Now, as you can imagine, Chris, Twitter had some thoughts about this, about how this was unfair to Mandy because, yes, they market her for sex appeal. Others found it justifiable because she's using WWE IP to market herself to do all these things. Not necessarily the money part, but at least the nudity. There's some things on there that are a little bit past the point of OnlyFans, should those be an OnlyFans type, bordering on pornography. What say you?
All right, let me give you a third course here. So, on one hand, the company is right and correct to part ways with Mandy Rose, who is making softcore pornographic content. On the other hand, where does the unfairness to Mandy come in? I believe that if we had access to the timeline of what did WWE know and when, that the story would be fairly clear that they made poor choices here to allow this to progress, and that they were aware of the content of Mandy Rose's fan whatever thing, not only fans, whatever it's called, fan page, I don't know. And if that is the case, then you knew what she was doing. It's like the, I'm sort of reminded like the scorpion and the frog. You're marketing her as a sex pot character. Every part of the presentation of this person that you have elected to do is marketed around the sex, which is relevant not necessarily because of the double standard, but because if you know that she is running some sort of OnlyFans type thing, it's not hard to connect the dots what the content of that would be.
Okay, let me stop you and give you another silence. What if this was the first time they found out? Because according to this story by Dave in the Observer, it is believed she was fired without being given the option to take the stuff down and tone down her site. Does that change your opinion?
If it's the first time, I just don't know that it is. I think like that, even that little factoid there could be, this is the first time that they've addressed it with Mandy. And that they weren't in, or more importantly, they weren't even interested in trying to address it with Mandy.
Well, according to some reports, and this is just hearsay, so not a fact, but Mandy knew she was out of line doing this and she was afraid of getting caught.
Yeah, she had to know what she was doing here. Was not a good call. I mean, that's the other part that I think does not play very well in Mandy Rose's favor, which is, not to get too philosophical here on a Saturday afternoon, but sort of like the Kantian, put yourself in the other person's shoes and imagine how you would be doing this. If Mandy Rose pretended to be WWE executive Amanda, what's her last name? Whatever her name is. You know, she's executive Amanda Sacamano, and she knows about this. She would fire said employee. Like, she would know that this would be a problem. So she of course had to know what she was doing was not a good idea when she was doing it. And I think that does not play very favorably for those who are sympathetic to it. And like, I get that, like, a lot, there is this component of women's wrestling that is very much about sex and sexuality. That is always true. And that's going to get involved in the marketing. And some characters are going to be very heavily marketed towards that. And Mandy Rose is extremely on one end of the spectrum. But that does not open up a permission structure for the people marketed very heavily on the sexuality side to then have special rules and carve outs for being able to do OnlyFans. Whereas someone who is not marketed like that, like, I'm just pulling a name here on like the far extreme end, Wendy Chu, where like the rules have to be tighter on a Wendy Chu, but they're more permissive for Mandy Rose, depending on how they're being presented on television. I don't think that that logically makes a lot of sense either. So I am not particularly sympathetic to Mandy Rose here. She knew what she was doing. She's probably making good money off of this. And let's be fair about in-ring Mandy Rose. I don't think she is as bad as
not
many
all.
People do. And I mean, I just as evidence for this, watching that match this week, her cartwheel into the dropkick looked pretty darn tight. Like that looked good. She can do stuff in the ring. I think that she's a pretty decent act, not like an elite act, certainly never going to be a Hall of Fame act. She's not Trish Stratus Part Two or anything like that, but I don't think she's trash. But you know, is it worth fighting for either? You know, that's the other part of this.
Probably not. And I think I fixed my sound finally. We, yeah. And she's not, I don't think she's going to be on AEW's radar. Definitely.
I think that would be a mistake. I think she actually would bring something different to AEW. Here's the case. I think AEW could benefit from having Mandy Rose. As I said, I don't think she's as bad as a lot of people do.
No, and
I think
she's not.
And the other way of looking at this is WWE just spent a year and a half developing her for you with like a main event presentation. She's been main event trained. Like she knows how to, like, at absolute minimum, slide into this AEW roster and, you know, have a faction and carry that faction. She's a decent promo. I think one of the things that she does pretty well is the talking part of it.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens there. I actually think she may apologize and come back eventually, but she's making main roster money on the NXT roster, and she was making more from this service than she was on the roster. So, I mean, she chose she chose a bag. She can't have both bags. She's going to go with the one that makes her more. Take what you want.
And I think, like, you know, this is the other thing where you can't knock the hustle, but you can't cry for it either.
No, you can't condone the hustle either.
She was just trying to double dip on the bags, people. Yeah. Like she had one bag, she realized she could get another bag, and she was trying to hang out as long as she can. I have done something like this in the past where I have had a second job where, you know, I'm on my way out, but try to hang out of the second job while I'm doing the other job. Just why not get paid twice if you can? You can't fault that, but when the gravy train comes to an end, we do not pull out the violin and start playing a concerto.
No. Tony Khan announced on December 10th that Ring of Honor's broadcast deal would be weekly shows on a revived Honor Club subscription service. Key to that announcement is that he was unable to secure either a television deal or a paying streaming deal that would be financially viable to accept. Relaunch service would be $9.99 per month and include weekly television shows and the full ROH library, including past pay-per-view shows. Chris, I ask you, who's going to watch this with all the free television wrestling and YouTube wrestling that's already out there?
You know, I think this is going to be a really exciting product for upwards of 1,000 people, Jeffrey.
They were
maybe
saying
1,500.
There might be a tie-in with New Japan World, and that would intrigue me. But other than that, unless I'm getting Briscoe promos every week, no thank you.
Yeah, right? No, I mean, really what Khan would need to do is try to get a synergy with New Japan World and hope that, like, you know, yeah, that might help stuff. But I don't know about that.
As reported on the very network you're listening to on the Voices of Wrestling flagship show,
Sasha Banks' deal is the largest Bushiroad has ever agreed to as far as a per-date deal, and it is larger than what they were paying Chris Jericho. The deal is with New Japan, but would include one date for Stardom. That would be for a show that is expected in April, but the company had planned for the biggest show in its history, which will be tentatively announced on December 29th at the Stardom Sumo Hall show. They're hoping that Sasha's crossover appeal to WWE fans and Star Wars fans can help them with one major show, with the idea of that show to build the perception to the public of the company. She and WWE did not reach terms for a new contract. WWE directly wouldn't say anything about her, but those in the company over recent months had said that the sides were not close on money. She was said to be seeking a number along the lines of Becky Lynch and Charlotte Flair, and those internally have said she wasn't offered numbers close to that. They said that she's not seen internally as somebody who would be on top for the next 5 years, but it is seen as someone who could get a singles or tag team title run, but has peaked as a star aside from the reality that was acknowledged that if she would return, there would be a honeymoon period where people would go nuts for her. I think WWE is dead wrong in this case. Sasha Banks is younger than all those people. Sasha Banks is younger than Bianca Belair. She's younger than Ronda Rousey. She's younger than Becky. She's younger than Charlotte. I
imagine thinking that Sasha has peaked, but not Charlotte.
I know. And the thing is, they did part of this is their fault, because they always chose Charlotte over Sasha time after time after time.
Again, or Ronda, for that matter. I mean, Ronda peaked very quickly, much like her MMA career. She came in, you know, there was like a little flash, and you're like, oh, this is intriguing. And then just like her combat sports career, not so much.
If I'm Tony Khan, I am talking to New Japan, and I am saying, hey, would you help me here offset some of the cost to bring her in? Because number one, Sasha's all about the bag. If you watched that Stone Cold session with her, she is all about the money. And she says, you know, I'm no longer about the piece of pizza or the hot dog and the soda and the thank yous and feeling grateful. I eat steak like Vince McMahon. You know, we've said this for months. She's the game changer for AEW. They get her. What about Kota Ibushi? Man, Kota Ibushi ain't moving numbers like Sasha Banks. I'm sorry to all the Japanese wrestling fans. Now, would you be able to survive?
It occurred to me this week that, like, bringing in Sasha with Mandy Rose too would be a real injection. No, for real. Like, I don't think you'd actually pay that much for Mandy either.
That's true. And it would,
yeah, no, I mean, I think she ends up being like, you know, kind of like a cash considerations tie in here.
Okay, you can do it as long as you're not doing a quote unquote sports entertainment faction invading.
No, I'm not saying bring him in. I wouldn't bring him in as a sports entertainment faction. Right? Okay. No, like, look, Chris Jericho has exhausted us on this. How much more could we possibly do? Well, I say this, but it's AEW. They seem to love this trope. But no, I wouldn't bring them in as a sports entertainment faction. I think that they would, both of them respectively, would be able to draw a lot of energy from that crowd.
AEW made a major hire this week with Michael Manzuri as the new senior vice president and co-executive producer with Tony Khan going forward. He started on this week's television. Part of the deal is that Warner Brothers Discovery and Khan had decided to change the look of the show. The plan changes will go into effect in January. Mansouri worked for WWE from 2009 until quitting the company in May 2020. He got promotion after promotion and was named vice president of global television production in 2016. He was for a time considered to be the guy who would replace Kevin Dunn, with the idea that when Vince McMahon left, and nobody really leaves, whatever that would be, Dunn would eventually get replaced by Mansouri. But he didn't wait that long and became executive producer of Pat McAfee's podcast, a spectacular show, and then was hired as senior vice president and executive producer for One, and had worked there for 16 months. So AEW is going to be changing its look a bit and hopefully getting some of the bugs out of its television production. How strong of a hire do you think this is, Chris?
It remains to be seen. Hopefully it will result, yes, in not having some of these weird little glitchy moments that they are prone to having.
Yeah.
I wonder if those glitchy moments will be offset by new and improved ways of doing camera coverage.
Ratings are bad for most people. They were up for AEW this week. Raw on December 12th tied an all-time record for the lowest viewer total on the USA Network for the show and set a record for the lowest first hour ever. NXT, 660,000 this week. SmackDown, over 2 million. SmackDown did its best total viewer number since the September 23rd Bray Wyatt tease episode, doing a 1.36 rating. I don't have AEW's numbers, but I think it was like 960,000. It was over 900,000 this week, though. And if you watch Raw, I know we're in silly season. I know we're in football season. I know there's all sorts of excuses, but these numbers, and a lot of them are coming during the women's segments, are a bit troubling.
And I don't really have a lot of like deep thoughts about anything on WWE's television this week. And I watched it all, but it felt like we have very much regressed. And you know,
or at least we're in a state of doing nothing while we wait for the Rumble to come along.
Yeah, but like I guess maybe for me it was that like wraparound poker segment thing from a couple of weeks ago. Where that like that was like the real Rubicon moment of like, oh, are we just we're going back? It feels like we're not we've stopped evolving, and we're not trying to change the product beyond the tweaks that have been made. Many of which have been nice quality of life improvements, but still ultimately, like, it's like we stop short of making Walter Walter again and making Pete Dunne again. We, you know, yes, Tegan Knox is Tegan Knox. There's just a lot of half measures.
Xia Li, we still don't know what to do with.
Right. Yeah. Just a lot of half measures going on WWE television. And it's, kind of, it you know it's become less interesting, and I don't think it doesn't have a great week to week flow or anything. Like it felt like maybe a month or two ago that they would be starting to really think about longer form booking patterns and stuff like that, and now it almost feels like we've kind of regressed a little bit to week to week.
No sponsor this week. That ends the news segment. Now Lazy River. Whatever we watched, whatever we saw, and there was a lot to watch this week because, hey, I watched both the Ring of Honor pay-per-view and NXT Deadline, so there's lots to talk about there. I'm going to start off with something that made me laugh until I cried, and I shouldn't laugh this hard at these things, but Chris, did you watch SmackDown last night?
Yes.
You know, not every big guy has to be Bam Bam Bigelow, and God bless Top Dollar. He points to the sky. He runs the ropes. He goes to dive over the top ropes. Doesn't quite make it. Was not hurt, luckily, but did a cartwheel over the ropes pretty much. Not a cartwheel, but you know, he hits the top ropes and just kind of does that rope flip thing. He lands on his feet. Everybody sells for him. And he gets high fives all the way around. Look, let big guys be big before. Guys.
I've said it. No, here's the thing with Top Dollar, though. He's unsafe at any speed. He's like that Ralph Nader book. That when he's doing power moves, he is also dangerous. So I am very down on Top Dollar.
Hold on. Would you rather take a choke slam or a dive from Top Dollar?
Oh boy, that is actually no. I'm going with the dive because there's a decent chance he doesn't get to me. The choke slam, I am very much worried about that angle, just like accordioning my neck and folding me up like a roll of quarters.
I will go after you do one because I am going to talk a little Ring of Honor. I'm not sure you watched it.
I did not watch Ring of Honor.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, But with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You can display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading. So you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally, and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived. And really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys and reach in my pocket or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition. 1 second, door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is EUFY Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, EUFY Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
No, I did not watch Ring of Honor. I guess we can, man, where do I want to start here? This is a tough one. I guess we can do Deadline. We can go into a little bit of Deadline here. Breaker and Cruz never really got to speed for me. I'm looking at the match runtime here at 14 minutes. In my head, these guys just had a lot more, like there was going to be more to this. And I just didn't really feel like it got, it wasn't bad, but it was too predictable.
It wasn't bad, but at that moment where they did the whole, he's going into his head thing and his eyes bugged out, I flipped off. I just couldn't, I stopped paying attention to the match. And I don't know why they chose that as a story.
It didn't yield anything.
No,
was my thing. Yeah, it's fine to have this match be the point that heel turns Apollo Crews. I'd be absolutely on board with that. He realizes, you know, the standard Apollo strategy isn't going to be enough. He's going to have to go to the dark side. He tries to go to the dark side, and even then he comes up short. And now we continue the Crews story, but we didn't really even get that, and just kind of moved to the finish. That's kind of how I felt about the whole show. Like, a lot of this stuff was, you know, well within what I'd call, like, the passable, like, you know, not bad. It totally not offensive in any way. But, like, something kept it from really kind of snapping into that next level for me. Everything other than, of course, Aladon on fire, which was just gone.
Oh, good Lord.
That was just a dumpster fire. You couldn't save that.
The ref with the goo. I was like, man. They've built up this brand so well, and they're going back to main roster stuff. Now, that being said, I thought the Iron Survivor matches and the tag team matches over-delivered. I thought the women's Iron Survivor was a lot of fun. And I owe an apology. I mock her a lot because the character's so dumb. But Kiana James brought it in that match. She is a brick crap house compared to the other women in that match, and she's throwing them around, and she's just she's overselling a bit because her selling's not necessarily up to that pro level yet. She's playing to the back of the room, but she was selling quite well, I thought, for her level. And, you know, and the story they told was pretty fantastic. Of course, Roxanne Perez is the one. I mean, she's fantastic. I love the story of Cora Jade trying to screw her at every moment. That's going to be a fun feud to watch. And then the men, I thought they were going to do the story that they didn't do, but the story that they did was perfectly fine. And I thought everybody, like, I loved the little shot of, like, Axiom deciding to beat up McDonough in the penalty box. I don't know what that, I mean, the little things, this could have been overscripted and overproduced, but it didn't feel that way. Maybe with the exception of everybody having to chase Grayson Waller as opposed to trying to get a pin on somebody else. But I thought those were good.
Yes, right. That was the only, like, psychology mistake. I would have had them all try to chase after Waller and then simultaneously realize, no, we actually could just fight each other.
Yeah.
Which is also a good way to sort of turn the tables on the heel in the, oh, I'm just going to run away sort of approach to this. Because, like, that actually doesn't solve his problems. And this mistake there, I thought at the end was, oh, yeah, well, I'll just run away. No, that actually doesn't work in this match, if you think about it. I thought, as well, on the men's match, Joe Gacy's showcase spots were quite impressive.
Fiery babyface Joe Gacy was fantastic, I thought.
I saw a lot in Joe Gacy in this match that I had not heretofore seen. And he was definitely the sort of standout performer for me. I'm like, oh, Joe Gacy, I get it. There's a thing here with this guy. I see it.
And then the New Day and Pretty Deadly was nothing but fun. I mean, the quadruple Eddie spot where the referee just looks at everybody and like, all of you are being ridiculous. Get up. I know what's going on here. They work very, very well together. It was said in an interview by somebody that New Day's goal here is to help elevate Pretty Deadly to another level. We'll see how that goes in the feud, but that match itself was nothing but fun.
Yeah, that being said, on Wednesday, one of the cringiest parts of Wednesday's NXT show was the New Day coming out there and demanding that people from another country say the American Pledge of Allegiance. You could have a title shot if you say the Pledge of Allegiance.
That was a heel move right there, but at the same time...
It's really, really bad, right? Like it's like asking somebody to say a prayer of a denomination you know they aren't.
Well, yeah, but you got the two guys from the bar are, of course, country redneck hillbillies who will know this, and the two Brits will not know the Pledge of Allegiance. So I viewed it as a less...
I didn't think it was a pop quiz. I thought they knew the Pledge of Allegiance, like, and the way that they were selling it, it was more that the Pledge of Allegiance was so anathema to these deeply British men that they wouldn't say it. It would sort of defile them.
That's the other issue. Yeah, I don't think Pretty Deadly know the Pledge of Allegiance. I just don't.
Why not? They're in America, damn it.
Well, did we lose a war or something? Chris turns suddenly patriotic. What happened there?
All right. Where are we going next?
I am going to go to Ring of Honor Final Battle. My match of the year was on this show, Chris. The Briscoes versus FTR in a double dog collar chain match is everything I want in professional wrestling. When they tell you it would fit at home with such and such event of years past, they mean it. This came straight out of Starrcade 84, 85. Blood everywhere, guys fighting for their lives. It's the Briscoes, so they're gonna bump like mad. Cash and Dax were awesome in this match. It's everything I want in wrestling, Chris. I just want bad men doing bad things and a lot of hate, and for it to be in a blow-off match where you feel like the two guys working, or the two teams working with each other, don't really like each other. Yes, there's quote-unquote mutual respect, but at the same time, do you really like them? Or do you just respect them? And this one, this is my favorite match of the year. I don't think I'm going to, I mean, I loved the first match on Mania weekend. It was fantastic as a wrestling match, but this was a fight. And I adored this match, Chris. It was fantastic. Go out of your way to see this.
It baffles me why Tony Khan isn't trying to present this stuff on his television more. Not like the necessarily the blood and guts component of this, but like, these are the storylines that seem to really resonate with people. I've heard nothing but good reviews on this match all week, and yet it's an off-the-beaten-path match. Like, by which I mean the phrase, go out of your way to see this, is associated with this match, which yes, belies the fact that it's not conveniently viewable. That's dumb.
And they don't have guys who can cut promos like the Briscoes. I'm sorry. But that's part of it. The build is always part of it. And they're two guys who you believe would live and die for these belts, but also hate anybody who comes into their path. And I just, yeah. Another match that over-delivered, I thought, Athena and Mercedes Martinez was, I mean, other than the end was dumb. It was, she takes a turnbuckle pad off and then eventually drop kicks Mercedes into the exposed turnbuckle. And the referee has done nothing to try and fix the turnbuckle after she took off the pad, but the match itself was a lot of forearm shivers to the face, which I enjoyed. I mean, it was a little strong, styly. It was pretty darn good, but the entire card was good. I wouldn't say it was great, but those two matches to me stood out more than any others. Your turn, Chris.
Okay. All right. Let's move to SmackDown. Not a ton on SmackDown to talk about, in my opinion, in the ring, other than obviously we're going to get a big return of John Cena next week. And we finished off with a Bloodline segment. This is not like, this is not one of the best Bloodline segments for me. No. I kind of liked it. I kind of liked it in the sense that there's clearly the homage to the Godfather. Like, you know, we're going to make him today. Like Sammy Uso is the Joe Pesci character.
You're mixing up Goodfellas.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's Goodfellas. Yeah. No, they were doing a little bit of a Goodfellas thing here, but I also, for me, Sammy's saying he's my only friend or I'm his only friend didn't really work as like a moment, because
although that is a Godfather 2 moment, if you think about Fredo saying, yeah, Johnny Ola took me to this place when I was here last time, and Michael didn't know at the time, but yeah, it didn't work for me either, but go ahead.
No, it just didn't work for me because we've never really seen anything to like why would Sammy still consider Kevin to be his friend?
I think it was supposed to be a verbal slip and it couldn't come out that way.
Yeah, it felt more like a revealing of psychology thing, and there's just it's an unearned revelation of psychology.
Yeah, it's an unearned revelation.
Yeah, so I didn't think that worked. That was, I mean, look, you know, like they're not Shakespeare. This is not, but like normally these actually work pretty well. And this I didn't think landed so well. Other than one thing that does seem clear, I mean. And this is where I think they sort of tipped the hand, is that like they're already turning on Sammy.
Yeah.
They're turning on Sammy like immediately. And I think there really should have been a grace period where he was the golden child.
It feels like they finally scripted this out and said, we don't have enough time. We need to get this done before the Rumble.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. We missed the really important part here where Sammy for like a month needed to be like the golden god of the Bloodline.
He needed to be truly accepted and almost to the point where he's trying to take more power in the Bloodline.
Right, right. No. We need an Icarus thing where he flies too high. Like there's a night where he's tagging with Roman and they're cheering him more than Roman. And that's finally what pisses off Roman.
What do we think of the, I don't know if we talked about this, but it looks like they're doing a reboot of Lacey Evans back to what we thought she should be when she was first brought up to the main roster.
I mean, I think it's incredibly exciting to see Lacey Evans 5.0, and I can't wait for the next. I can't wait to talk about
late,
the next.
Isn't it? It's too late to salvage.
No, Lacey Evans is Lex Luger. We've done it too many times.
Yeah. So is Xia Li in some ways, because she's face, she's heel, she's face, she's heel.
Right. And I really, yes, we're both these people like Dynamo top, you know, build the roster around them types. No. But like both of them had something. So, Xia Li was a little dangerous with the kicks, right? But like both of them had something. And I think we've missed the boat with both of them.
I am pleased on Raw that Akira Tozawa got some time to be Akira Tozawa again rather than bad Japanese stereotype.
Oh, yeah. God, like his fire up spots are so great. And it's, he's someone who. The crowd is going to immediately, they always do, and this was no exception. He just has a style of offense, and with the facials and everything too, real expressive, and just like an intensity to the way he does stuff. It's not like the same sort of like physicality of Shabab, but there's just like something very like a whole of body motion when he is doing things that is very energizing. I would love to see them do more with him. And I think, honestly, him being aligned with the Street Profits is a good thing, as opposed to go on your own and get the Ricochet treatment.
Yeah. Anything else from WWE?
Oh, boy. If anything, the notable thing on WWE... I do have one more thing on WWE.
Oh, yes.
Kevin Owens and Elias had me in tears with that backstage segment, wrapping around like all of the babyface and heel stuff into a full bit. Owens is just, he's just so funny. His comedic timing is absolute aces. I enjoyed, that was the best segment of the best moment on Raw was that backstage interaction.
All right, hold on. What was funnier? What? That segment or Dominic Mysterio's acting after getting misted?
No, that segment. Because
Dominic ain't Olivier. Let's put it that way.
You know how I feel about the Mysterio family.
Yes.
These are humans. These are
robots who, pretending to be humans. That's who they are.
No. These are humans bringing in an exceptional amount of acting ability to a show that doesn't deserve it. Actually what I was trying to say, but we can go with what you said too. That's fine. I mean, yeah, I'm watching it. Oh, he's taking the mist. I mean, devastating.
In the medical
station there.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he probably needed to go to a local hospital.
Oh my gosh, I've been misted. He's staying in the trainer's room.
yeah. Right, I know, and a doctor would have to then do toxicology on that to figure out what substance is in this poor man's eyes. I'm sure Rhea was worried sick.
So we have movement, at least, on Bray Wyatt. We saw Uncle Howdy on Friday. We've also been seeing Alexa Bliss acting up, but we've also seen Asuka acting up. Is Alexa Bliss a red herring and it's just going to be Asuka, or is it going to be both of them?
I think it ends up being both of them. And I also don't think they know what the hell they're doing, because if you remember when they brought out Bray Wyatt 3.5 or whatever iteration this is, we had like the makings of an Alice in Wonderland like faction, and Uncle Howdy was supposed to be the Mad Hatter stand-in, and now he's just turned into Howdy Doody, only scary. And I mean, Uncle Howdy is a terrible character. You know
what? No, I want to belt him. I want to give him the Intercontinental title.
You know, honestly, no. You turned me on this. I think ultimately, ultimately, Uncle Howdy should be the one to dismantle the bloodline. I think that's the only thing that can narratively satisfy everything. Person pulling Sami Zayn's strings is actually Howdy.
Yeah. So that leaves us with Winter is Coming. How do we feel about the Jericho thing?
The Action Andretti thing.
Action Andretti, yeah.
You know.
Okay, go ahead.
Here's what worked, or I think what was real critical about that, insofar as it worked because people did not think Andretti was going to get the win. They thought he was going to get like a courtesy spot, like kicking out of the Codebreaker. And even that was not for certain. Like it was entirely plausible that Jericho could have won off of that Codebreaker. And when he kicked out of that going into the commercial break, you know, that got the crowd into it. I thought the reaction was really good and organic. You know, him beating Jericho, what did that do, is sort of my question. And then the other thing I was thinking about was, do you remember the time where Jack Perry had a match with Chris Jericho?
Yes.
And the whole thing is, can you last in the ring against Chris Jericho? And here comes Jobby Jobberson, and he ends up pinning Jericho. What does that say about Jack Perry's experience?
That was my big hang up with it. It's not that I didn't like Action Andretti. He's fine. But this was a move that you need to do with one of the...
He is just fine. He is a skilled, well-coordinated young wrestler who does the aerial young stuff. Wrestler in his 20s, create a wrestler aerial stuff. Yes, it is a fine, perfectly cromulent wrestler. But there's nothing notable.
Yes, this is the type of win that you needed to give to Perry, Ricky Starks, maybe Sammy, maybe, you know, on the Darby, Orange Cassidy. Hell,
or even a young unknown wrestler who has an established character. Andretti's just like, he's not a well-formed character. He looks and reminds me of a creator wrestler I had in my teenage years called Jack Flash, who was like the most generic, like, yeah, guy. Like you know, I did some high moves and stuff. No personality.
Takeshita could have used this win, yes, to be honest with you.
I mean, if you're going to have Jericho, quote unquote, lose to a jobber, you want them a little less known than like Takeshita is the only reason why I'm like trying to come up with, you know, a name or whatever. But yeah, you know, some young, not Warhorse, obviously, but like some young, relatively unknown, established character who you want to start pushing.
Yes.
I don't think Andretti's the guy for that.
No, I didn't think so either. You know, the story about Chris having a slump, I get that. Is he going to see the fear? And I know everybody else had it because I was on Twitter after it happened, is that, oh, Jericho just gets his win back next week. Now, I thought it would have been interesting if Jericho challenges him again next week and loses and then offers a title or offers a contract if he can win. But he was already signed this past week after the win. So that ruins it. Because I would have had Jericho then kick him in the nuts and then win.
Well, and that's also the problem with him winning cleanly over Jericho versus winning via disqualification or a countout, is that narratively, yeah, if someone comes in and beats Chris Jericho, the first AEW champion, they should be getting offered a contract.
Yes. Yeah, it should be Sean Dean against MJF.
Right. No, it should be a big deal. They had a model for this. Yeah, you stole it from me right there. Sean Dean and MJF is a much clearer model for how this should have went than what they did here with Action Andretti. I view this more as a teachable moment for booking rather than like a triumph or, you know, a great moment.
What did you think of MJF and Starks?
Boy, I thought the mistake was making this for the title and the diamond ring. I think that this should have just been for the diamond ring, because then that would have actually offered some intrigue that Starks could have won. I just think it opens a lot more interesting stories. I think the match, there are some real issues getting MJF up for old Ricky. And I think like a lot of those, what were supposed to be Rochambeau moments or Powerbomb moments or whatever they were supposed to be, like those key moments just didn't quite happen the way they needed to. They were unfortunately very highly profiled, botchy looking spots. And you know, I think the kick to the balls spot too just was very uninspired. I didn't think the finish of this match was particularly well thought out or done in a way that made, like, Ricky should have at least had MJF's first cheat attempt covered.
Right.
Right? And then MJF gets him with the second one. So he actually
Starks is still kind of heelish, even in his baby persona. He should know these things are coming.
Well, yeah. And you know, yeah, it's like he's street smart, right? So, like, he should have had a cup on. And then MJF, like, you know, gouges him in the eyes or something like that. I didn't think that enough happened in this match to really help Starks.
Yeah, the thing I took heat for, and probably still am a little bit from certain people, I hated this Kenny Omega promo after the six man, because it almost felt like he was phoning it in, as opposed to being angry about the hammer spot or being angry that they were, all right, if you want to use the hammer, let's just use all the weapons. And he's starting to cut it before the guys have left.
No, my whole thing, and that's how I felt about that match too, is that it was campy. Yes. I get what they're referencing. I too have watched basketball in the aughts. I'm familiar with the Paul Pierce running back to the hardwood off of the wheelchair. I know what they're trying to do here. Injury angle down 3-1. Dead triangle blows a lead.
And it didn't feel like he was really injured when he was doing the walk back either. It was so turned up to 11 and campy. And you're just like, oh my God, really? It's almost like they're mocking this stuff.
Like what they're doing right now is like some weird parody of a best of seven series.
Yes.
Like in the NBA or whatever. And In fact, a lot of people find the narrative structure of a best of seven series in both baseball and the NBA to be deeply satisfying. People like stories over seven panels. They're not necessarily looking for a rib on it.
Yeah, I didn't understand this beat. I expected escalating matches in terms of, okay, tired of this hammer, let's do a no DQ. I expected the ladder match in match seven, which is going to happen at the Kia Forum.
Or do an actual injury. Do an actual freaking injury.
With the hammer. Good Lord. That's what it's there for.
Take out Nick. Take him out. That's where it becomes interesting. How do Omega and Matt figure it out? And, like, you know, you have Callis, like, teasing, oh, I'll find a third guy. Or, you know, like, you know, that's where the twist, I think, actually comes in, is you have one of the Bucks go down.
Put Nakazawa in there.
They have to carry Cutler to the victory. Like, you know, it's like bringing in the bench guy. You have to start the bench player.
He's the Brian Scalabrine of the Young Bucks, and they bring him in, and the Jack Haley of the Lakers at the time. Yeah, one of those types of deals. I was watching the match. It was fine. It was technically sound, as they say, and, you know, the flippy doos were good, but at the same time, I'm watching the Bucks, I'm watching Omega, and I'm just like, these guys are like almost going at 50% because they don't feel it emotionally, and it took me out of the match, to be honest with you.
Oh, and, like, let's talk about Penta, shall we?
Sure.
Is there anyone who has become more underwhelming over the last 5 years than Penta?
No, because he was a vicious monster to be feared.
The vicious monster to be feared. No, like, years ago on my VPW2 cartridge, I made Penta because, like, this is like his peak Lucha Underground, you know, era. He was devastating. He was like a combination of like several things. There was like martial arts to his offense. There was high flying stuff in his offense. And then there was just really savage suplexes and holds and stuff in his offense. And now it's just cero miedo, and he slaps you in the chest. And it's like three spots. He is a WWE character. And it'll just always baffle me why he didn't just sign the WWE contract, because all he wants to do is have a WWE version of his match anyways. Mm-hmm. He's not trying to make art, people.
Yeah, he wants to do his catchphrases. He wants to do the glove spot, and he wants to do a somersault
and let his brother do any of the work, right? Yeah, like that's the other genius of this is he outsourced any real work that he needs to do to his brother.
No, that's basically true. But yeah, I have nothing else in my lazy river.
I don't know that I have much else either. This was a very sort of ho-hum week of wrestling otherwise.
Yeah. Go out of your way to watch the two pay-per-views. I think they were both pretty good, if anybody hasn't. But if you're going to watch one match this week, go watch the Briscoes and FTR just absolutely tear each other apart. It was a lot of fun. But this has been Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins. You can follow me on the Twitter at CrapGame13. You can just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. We were part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Chris doesn't do Twitter anymore, but he does do Instagram. He's going to tell you about that now.
Yeah, you can go and follow me on Instagram. If you're interested in guitar lessons, you can get those. Go to Instagram.com/DrDOCTOR_NOV, Dr. Nove on the Instagram. You can keep up with all my musical happenings. There's gonna be a lot of music dropping in the early part of 23, so keep up with me. A lot of stuff's on the horizon in terms of musical stuff, because I've been, as Jeff's aware, writing up a storm over the last few months here.
Yes, and we'll see you next week.
Hola, hola, my name is Ricardo. I am the host of the Lucha Jobbers podcast here in the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. We are a Spanish-speaking show dedicated to discussing and analyzing pro wrestling from all across the world. From AEW to CMLL, we talk about American wrestling, Japanese wrestling, and of course, Lucha Libre. If something big happened in the pro wrestling world, we will talk about it. So if you know Spanish or have a friend that knows Spanish or want to practice your Lucha Libre pronunciations, go listen to the Lucha Jobbers podcast right here in the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. Nos vemos por ahí.